Very casual. In fact, there are times I wish I could hide the microphone. when did you arrive in New York?
Last Sunday, yeah. I'm going out this Sunday.
Yes. Spending a week then, huh?
Yeah.
Primarily to commemorate the publication of the book, is that right?
No. Primarily vacation, actually. I'd come to the end of a long sequence of books, and I thought I needed a break.
Vacation in New York in the winter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you spend your entire life sitting behind a keyboard looking out of the window, you know, New York is a good vacation.
Well, you came at the right time. We're in a cold wave.
Yes, but the sun is nice. You know, we have the cold in England, but less sun.
Actually, I've lived in quite a few places in the United States, in the Midwest and the South. And the New York climate, in spite of complaints about it by people who live here, is not all that bad.
No, I think, I mean, compared to England, certainly I arrived last Sunday, and it was actually colder in England than it was when I got here, and I thought that was terrific. But then a couple of days ago, the wind chill factor, am I right, started to creep in, and I actually went to the extent of investing in a $1 hat.
All I wear is a London fog with a zip-end lining.
Yeah.
But I was in Houston, Texas a while back visiting. My family lives in Houston, and it was over Thanksgiving. Now, Houston is known for having a very warm climate, very humid. And it's because it's so humid and so damp that even though the temperature is not too low, you get a chill.
Yeah.
And I remember getting into an automobile. I'll never forget. I just got this terrible chill. Like that. And I don't think I couldn't have been colder in my life. Hmm. And yet the temperature may have been in the 40s or 50s.
Yeah.
Well, I flew back to New York, and I got off the plane at LaGuardia Airport, and I walked across the runway in my blazer, carrying my sport jacket and my London fog, and it was snowing.
Yeah.
And I was comfortable,
yes.
And it was so nice walking across the runway in the snow, and it felt good compared to that terrible, terrible climate in Texas.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've exhausted talking about the weather.
The weather. It's true. The Brits always start with talking about the weather.
I certainly enjoyed the Dead Giveaway. It was my introduction to your sleuth, Charles Perris. Actor.
Yes.
Tell me, now this is the 11th book with Charles Perris.
Yes, it's the 11th, yeah.
Wow, when did he start?
He started in, I guess it was 1974, I wrote the first one. And I was working, in fact I was working as a radio producer at the time, and I had an assignment to produce a series of adaptations of Dorothy L. Sayers' mysteries, featuring Lord Peter Wimsey. And I worked very closely with the guy who was adapting the books into scripts. And in a way, that was very good for me, because it sort of demystified the genre, if you like. And I'd always thought, you know, mysteries, you have to have an incredible sort of computer-like crossword brain and all this. And I suddenly, you know, going through with this guy, as he broke the scripts down and going through them with him, I suddenly realized that, in fact, good mysteries are a series of duologues, usually. I mean, they're like the sleuth interviews, you know, the maidservant interviews the lord of the manor interviews. And if you can actually make the dialogue interesting, make the characters interesting, there is usually about one fact that has to emerge from these encounters that, you know, that the top wasn't on the bottle of whiskey or whatever. That's the important thing. And yet you can make a kind of entertaining scene around that. And suddenly I thought, hey, just a minute, you know, I don't think I can do these clever crossword plots, but I think I can write dialogue, and maybe I could have a go at this, and, you know, make the scenes interesting, so it moves on quickly from scene to scene.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought maybe I should have a go. And also, while I was doing that series, I was working with a lot of middle-aged actors, and I find I'm fascinated by actors. You know, I'm just intrigued by what makes them tick, and they're so sort of self-obsessed. I mean, they're lovely, but they're totally... Somebody defined an actor as a person whose eyes glaze over when the conversation moves away from him. And I think that's true. I mean, they have this wonderful self-love, and yet they're very intense about their work, and yet they can be very jokey, and when they relax, they really relax. And I'm just intrigued by them as people. So I thought putting these two things together. And the third element, if you want, the psychological bit, was that my wife was pregnant with the first child, so maybe this was me, doing my own creative compensation. So I wrote the first Charles Perrow's book, Cast in Order of Disappearance, and the reaction was quite good to that, so I wrote another, and another, and another, and another, and here's number 11. Yeah.
Now, the first one, I would assume by the title, had a theatre motif.
Yes, the first one was really about unemployment and London theatre. And what I found as I go along, I mean, what is nice about it is that I, as a freelance writer, work in quite a lot of media. You know, I do little bits in the theatre, I write books, I write for radio, I write a little bit for television. And I often find that it feeds back into the Charles Perrow's books, that, you know, I take on a job to say, I mean, Dead Giveaway is a very good example, where I was going through a sticky patch as a freelance writer, as most people do. And a friend of mine was writing wacky questions for a television game show, and he was finding the work was sort of getting on top of him. He needed somebody else to come in and help write wacky questions. So I went to him for, I don't know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And what it gave me, I mean, it was a fairly excruciating experience while it was happening, but it gave me a background for this book. And I thought, hey, just a minute, game show, that's good. Yes, how could Charles get involved in a game show? And so I found a way of getting him involved, which is, I think, the most demeaning thing that's ever happened to him, where in this game show you have four people of given professions and members of the public have to guess which profession goes with which person. And they wanted to have an actor for no apparent reason, but they wanted an actor that nobody would recognise. So they wouldn't have seen him on television, they wouldn't have seen him in the theatre, and Charles got the job. And it just sort of went on naturally from there.
Well, if Charles thinks that's demeaning, he ought to work in New York, where most of the actors either drive cabs or wait tables.
Yeah, right, yes. I mean, I've done a book, in fact, the one before this, which was called Not Dead, Only Resting, is just about that. I mean, it's about unemployment and the sort of things that actors do to cover themselves while unemployed. Charles's case, decorating apartments and things. Yeah.
Well, tell me a little more about Charles Perris. Obviously, as you mentioned a moment ago, he was created from, I presume, a composite of middle-aged actors that you came across when you were working in radio.
Yeah.
But how has he changed at all over the course of the 11 books? Tell me a little bit about his character and his personality.
I don't know whether he has changed that much. I mean, I think what he retains always is a detachment from the theatre, from the media that he works in, you know, be it theatre or television or whatever. And he can always have a slightly cynical sort of onlooker's view. But it's like you have in a family, you know, that you can be rude about your sister, but God help the other person who tries to be rude about your sister. And it's the same with Charles in the theatre. You know, in other words, if anyone starts attacking the theatre, he will leap to its defence. I mean, he's very, very, you know, he couldn't imagine doing anything else. And although he's often out of work, and sometimes he hates what he does and he does some terrible things, there is just no thought that he could be anything other than an actor. But he does have this kind of detachment, so that he can sit on the sidelines and sort of watch a game show or something and see the sheer idiocy and the greed and all the things, you know, all the worst human values which are suddenly being touted for entertainment value. And so I hope that the reader sort of identifies with his viewpoint a bit.
It's kind of interesting how mystery writers such as yourself are always seeking unusual people to be the detective, in effect. And certainly these people, like Charles or Father Brown, Dave, what's his name, Hostetter?
Oh, yes, Brandstetter, is it?
Brandstetter, yeah. The homosexual detective, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Susan Isaacs as a Long Island housewife.
Yeah.
And, of course, Agatha Christie created a mystery writer, Mrs. Oliver, and a spinster, Miss Marple. And it seems to me that these people are always more interesting than the homicide detective who is...
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that there are two strands in mystery writing, which are the police procedural, you know, which is kind of Ed McBain at the best and various other people at the worst. And then there's the amateur sleuth tradition, which still goes on. And I think what's happened to mystery writing in the last 20 years is that the so-called golden age, you know, the 30s, 40s of mystery fiction, where there were puzzles, you know, they were really clever puzzles, and all that mattered was who done it. I think that has kind of gone, and it's gone because there are no good puzzles left. I mean, there are one or two, but that vein was so exhausted that very few people now sit down to write a mystery where the only interest is which of five interchangeable characters committed the murder. But I think rather than having a sort of cramping effect, it's had a liberating effect on the genre. And there's much more interest in writing now because the whodunit element is still there. You know, ideally at the end of the volume you discover who perpetrated the murder. But that is not the primary thing. And so you get much more sort of, I mean, you know, Dick Francis writing about racing. I mean, yes, you do discover who committed the murder, but on the way you find out a lot of interesting things about racing.
And other things.
Yeah.
His last book dealt with the phony wine,
yeah,
or
yes,
diluted wine.
The wine trade, or whatever. And I mean, I hope with my books that, you know, yes, you get to a solution, but also you find out something about how a certain area of the theatre works. And I just feel that crime writing is at an interesting phase at the moment, because you do get these books where the background is more important, you get books where the psychology is much more important. I mean, Ruth Rendell, that kind of, Patricia Highsmith, these people who are writing about the sort of morbid psychology of the murderer. And you get other books where humour is dominant, or, you know, even love interest you're now getting in crime. I think it's opening up a great deal.
You sound like you're a big reader of mysteries.
Yes, yes, I do read quite a lot. Yeah, yeah. And I'm also involved in England with the CWA, which is the Crime Writers Association, which is the equivalent of the MWA, Mystery Writers of America. So, yes, I'm quite involved in crime writing.
Since you've done so much reading, have you done enough reading of American material to make a comparison of how American mystery writing compares with British?
It's very interesting. I think what very rarely works is where the writers try to cross the Atlantic. In other words, English writing hard-boiled, you know, private eyes in Chicago or wherever generally fail. And equally, I think Americans writing cozy English mysteries, for me, tend to fail because they just make too many tiny mistakes. You know, the most successful for me are the ones where there's a lot of native life and native wit. I mean, I would think the early Gregory MacDonald, the Fletch books, I think are purely American but wonderfully entertaining to a British market. What's his name? Lauren D. Estelman, who did the Amos, whatever he is, the Chicago detective. I mean, very good, hard-boiled, which an English writer couldn't do. And I enjoy those. And also I enjoy what the English writers do, which probably the Americans couldn't, which is Ruth Rendell, I've mentioned, P.D. James, Dick Francis, obviously, Reginald Hill, people like this who are actually, you know, they're not trying to be... I think the worst thing that can happen in mystery fiction and probably television and everything else is that you try to become mid-Atlantic. You know, in other words, you try to appeal to both sides. I think you've got to write out of what you know and what you do well and hope that there is a spin-off that it appeals to another culture as well.
Well, it seems to me, as an observer of the publishing industry in this country, that... mysteries are more popular than ever here, and one of the ways that I've been able to gauge this is the creation of a number of bookstores in New York alone that specialize in mysteries. Now, there's the Mysterious Bookstore, there is
Murder Inc.
Murder Inc.
Yeah.
There's one in the Village. What's it called? It's a very nice shop.
Yeah,
but I can't think of the name. I have to check that. There's another one up in the Bronx. There are two more, at least, in New York, but they may not have regular store hours and do a lot by mail.
Yeah. But, and there are a lot of others round the country. You know, but that Murder was, by the Book and
that was never something that happened before. There were never full-time bookstores devoted exclusively to crime.
No. I mean, I think it's very encouraging that crime does seem to be attracting this kind of interest. The equivalent hasn't quite happened in England. There isn't really a specialist bookshop, though it might happen. I mean, there are mail-order dealers who deal exclusively in crime. That's happening. I think it has changed because I first came to New York, I suppose, 79 probably. And then Murder, Inc. was very well established. Otto Penzler was just about starting the Mysterious Bookshop. And that was it. And yet now when I come, you know, I hear about all these others. And I sort of, in fact, for the Crime Writers Association, I've been compiling a listing of American specialist bookshops, and it just gets bigger and bigger, and this is very encouraging. I mean, it's great that the interest is there. Whether the market is big enough in England for there to be specialists in the same way, I don't know. I think also it comes down to individual personalities, you know, the people who start these stores. Where I mean Dillis Wynne started Murder, Inc. Mm-hmm. Just because she liked mysteries and she thought maybe there was a market for it, and then she did the books called Murder, Inc. as well. Mm-hmm. Then when she passed the store over to Carol Brenner, she was very fortunate because she found another enormous enthusiast of mysteries who has a kind of encyclopedic knowledge and can tell you, you know, which was the first printing and when and where and what happened afterwards and when it was reprinted and all this, which is wonderful. I mean, all these things, I think, is terrific where they're born of enthusiasm, genuine enthusiasm. I think where they start to fall apart is where somebody sort of homes in and says, hey, this is a good market, let's see if we can, you know, exploit it. And I think, certainly in my experience so far, the people I've met who are in this area of mystery bookshops are all genuine enthusiasts. You know, it was the love of the genre that took them there, rather than thinking that there was something in it.
When you were in radio, who were you working with?
Inevitably, I was working with the BBC, because, uh-huh. I mean, the BBC is really the only... I was about to say creative radio organisation, but I mean all the other stations are kind of pop music stations with maybe a little bit of feature input. But I mean the BBC actually still does radio in the way that I think happened here, probably not since the 30s, where, you know, there are situation comedies, there are plays, there are all that kind of...
50s, actually. 50s, so,
sorry.
That began to die. I was in college in the 50s, and... actually, CBS was probably the last network to carry the dramatic shows.
Yeah. But you see, the BBC still does that. I mean, Radio 4 still does about two plays a day.
Yeah.
Right through. You can find situation comedies and all that.
You can find them in this country. Usually, they're found on FM stations,
mm-hmm.
or public stations, or.
And those are originals. I mean, they're new ones. They're not just repeating stuff.
Oh, not very much. Well, no. CBS, until... I think CBS still carries... now, I could be wrong about this. We don't carry it. The local CBS station, at whose studios we are making this tape...
Right.
did not carry the two CBS dramatic broadcasts. Now, I'm not sure they're still being run, although they used to record them out of control room D on the other side of this mm-hmm. wall. And then they found a studio up at the Columbia Recording Studio for Columbia Records, and they began working there. Now, this was the CBS Mystery Theater.
Yeah.
And then they had something called the CBS Adventure Theater. Now, since we never carried it, I've kind of lost track of it.
Yeah.
And I knew that they were... one of those broadcasts, at least, was carried on WOR for a while, and another one on WMCA. And then they kind of dropped out of sight. And I heard they were still being run, but you have to really dial switch to find
them.
CBS could not find an outlet.
I mean, I remember coming across, I'm interested in comedy and recording comedy and that kind of thing, and I've rooted through the BBC record library looking for mm-hmm. recorded stuff. And I remember coming across a very sad, I mean, funny, but sad LP by Stan Freberg, called Anyone Here Remember Radio? And it was obviously the LP he'd done, like, after he'd stopped doing the live radio shows. And it just kind of symbolised an era that had died. Because, I mean, I knew, you know, the best material from those radio shows, even in England. And suddenly it just all seemed to stop.
Oh, well, we all feel nostalgic in this country. I grew up with radio, of course, in the 40s. But in listening to the old shows, a lot of the... radio stations carry the old radio broadcasts, Jack Benny and Gangbusters and all the ones that I heard when I was a kid that you never heard because they were American.
Right.
But anyway, these were shows that I heard, and so a lot of, you can still pick them up. But they're really dated, and also it shows, because I like those shows so much, I now realize that I liked them when I was a child, and I listen to them now, and I see that they were really aimed at children primarily.
Yes, but on the other hand, I mean, that was a long time ago, and fashions in entertainment change. And I mean, I'm sure if you watch television shows of the same period, you would get the same kind of reaction. I mean, it just seems to me, I mean, who am I to pontificate on what American radio should be doing? But it seems a pity that they've lost that kind of creative element. I mean, I am now, you know, I'm currently writing a situation comedy for BBC Radio. And I just know that nobody is writing situation comedies for American radio. And it seems sad, because, I mean, it's a lovely medium. You know, it is actually a medium where you can develop ideas, you can talk, you can have people monologuing a bit. I mean, all, you know, you can do a lot of things in radio that you can't do in television.
People aren't going to listen to it. If people would listen to it, they would be on the air. But the stations that try to do this lose their audience.
Yeah.
What has happened? What has happened is this. In New York and in the immediate surrounding area, there are 140 radio stations, AM and FM. You can turn on your radio and just turn it a little bit, you'll hear another station, another and another. There are so many stations, it's overwhelming there are so many stations. Television, too. I get 31 channels on my television set, and they're all New York area through cable.
Yeah.
And just New York area, that's a huge amount. When I was a kid growing up, my father finally broke down and bought a television set. He was waiting for color, and this was in the 50s. He was a holdout waiting for color.
Yeah.
Finally caved in and bought a black and white. There was one television station on the air, and in the city I grew up in, and with an antenna on the roof, we could pick up another television station with a lot of snow.
Yes.
So, but now, everywhere you go, there are all these stations. So what has happened is that most stations develop their own identity and create formats. In New York, there are several stations. There are three or four stations that just have talk.
Mm-hmm.
People call in. There are psychologists on the air. They do sex shows, things like that. There are two all-news radio stations. This is one of them. There are stations that have a jazz format. There are two classical music stations and more rock and roll stations than you ever want to listen to.
Right.
Two country and western stations.
Yeah.
Two religious stations, and on and on and on.
Yeah.
Now, which station is going to bite the bullet and start broadcasting drama?
Serious drama.
And comedy?
Well, nobody is, because also it's much more expensive, because, I mean, you know, to pay one disc jockey and a pile of records is a lot cheaper than paying a director, a writer, 10 actors, or whatever it takes to make a radio play. I mean, it won't come back, I'm afraid.
Tell me about radio in London. Last time I was there, it was some years ago, seems to me I could pick up three stations in my hotel room radio, and it didn't seem like there was very much on the air. I picked up one station that I think was a pirate. They were a rock and roll station, and I don't know if they were from Holland or something.
Yes, else. Probably from the North Sea. There are some pirates out in the North Sea on boats. The BBC dominates broadcasting radio in England. Radio 1 is a kind of rock station, if you like, though it's pretty watered down for anyone who's heard a real rock station. Radio 2 is a sort of middle-of-the-road, easy-listening, you know, music station. Radio 3 is a very intellectual, mostly classical music during the day, except when there's a cricket match on and it carries the cricket. And very abstruse plays in the evening. I mean, that is the intellectual channel, with tiny listening figures, but very prestigious. And Radio 4 is the kind of it's the talk channel. I mean, it's news, and it's plays, and it's situation comedies, and it's anthology programs, and feature programs, and documentaries, and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, that that mops up the BBC, except they also have some local radio stations which are kind of competing with the local commercial stations, which are mostly rock shows, or probably not actually many of them are that hard rock. They go for a more middle-of-the-road sort of housewife
audience. How many commercial stations are there now?
Probably, I'm guessing, but I would think about 40. I mean, scattered 40? Around the country. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, there is also a BBC one sort of competing. And their fortunes are variable. I mean, some are doing well and some are doing badly.
These are private, independently owned stations?
Yeah. You know, whose income derives from commercials. Mm-hmm. Whereas the BBC is funded in a peculiar way, which is partly government grant and partly this thing called the licence fee, whereby, you know, if you buy a television monitor, you have to pay a licence fee. Currently, I think, £58 for colour, £58 a year, which, I mean, in fact, per day is peanuts. And it's partly that and partly the government, and there's a great debate going on at the moment as to whether this should change and whether the BBC should take commercials and start being sponsored.
Stations are a relatively new phenomenon, aren't they?
I suppose they've been around for between 5 and 10 years. And I mean, some of they're very variable. Some are very good, some are terribly boring. And there are also these pirate stations, as I say, a lot of which are based on boats in the North Sea. Radio Caroline, there was Radio Laser, but Radio Laser got, I think the boat hit something, or it sank, or, you know, so it was a bit sad. I think it was towed into a port and all the DJs were arrested.
American radio is not very good. You drive through the South and through the Midwest, turn on your radio, and most of the stations sound pretty much alike.
Mm-hmm.
Same music, and they sound like they have local high school boys spinning the records.
Yeah.
New York, of course, is wonderful. The station, there are a lot of 50,000-watt stations, which is the limit for an AM station here, but we do in this city a lot of interesting talk and news and things that you just don't get in the hinterlands.
Yeah.
It's easier to get a kid spinning rock records than employing an all-news staff.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's the cheapest form of broadcasting that's ever been invented.
Uh-huh.
And now there's the pop video has taken over. You have the equivalent on television,
yes,
as well.
And stereo, too, no less.
Yeah.
Now, in Dead Giveaway, you have your scenario is this a game show, and you must have done you must have gone over to was this? Tell me a little bit. What station was this supposed to represent?
Well, it's a commercial station. I mean, I worked as a producer in television for London Weekend Television.
WET, I think it's called. Right?
Yes, this is West End Television.
WET.
WET. I mean, I suppose my experience is obviously London Weekend Television, but I've also written for Thames Television, which is the other television station with a London franchise. So for reasons of variety, not to mention libel, I created WET, so you can't actually identify anyone. But I think if you thought in terms of London Weekend and Thames, you wouldn't be that far wrong. And I mean, the book, I hope, reflects what is happening in England, which is that television is just becoming more American. I mean, the number of game shows and things is growing by the day, and, you know, daytime game shows. And the BBC is quite as guilty as independent television in this, because the BBC is very, you see, to keep its kind of privileged status, the BBC has to be competitive. I mean, it has to show ratings as good as ITV's, if not better. So there are a lot of programmes that don't appeal necessarily to the highest intellectual sort of values. So, I mean, what this book is about, it's something that is happening a lot in England at the moment. It's about a game show that has been bought from America, where it's a big success, big rating success, and it's really about the piloting of this show to try and make it work for an English audience, and to, you know, that's the background, sort of fiddling around with the format, changing the name, changing the
I have to agree with the Americans in this book. Hats Off is a much better name than,
If
the Cap Fits. So that is a terrible name.
But you see, you don't have that expression. I mean, in England, that's a very common expression.
If the shoe fits.
Yes, but I mean, you wouldn't call a show if the shoe fits, would you?
No, wouldn't call it if a cap fits either.
Well, I mean, it's also, it's not, there is also meant to be the feeling that maybe the people running the show don't know what they're about, but I agree, Hats Off is a better name. So, I mean, that's really the background. It's just, you know, what happens, what kind of pressures are put on people when, and, of course, you have the American owners, the people, the copyright holders, are over monitoring the pilot at every moment, and they carry the Bible, which is actually this kind of all the received knowledge about how it worked in the States and how it developed. And so the English producer is up against these two breathing over his shoulder all the time as he tries to develop it for English television. And that's happening a lot. You know, you look now at all the new game shows, almost all of them have got a credit to some American company who originated it. I mean, we're behind on game shows, which I think is a great blessing, but unfortunately...
Sure. I wouldn't say that you were behind exactly.
But also the striking thing is that whenever I watch American game shows, I mean, the public are much more geared up for game shows. You know, they're prepared to show their emotions and jump up and down and scream and weep and all this, whereas the reticent British public, you know, you get the members of the public on, and they're not really, they don't like exposing themselves in this way on television. They're getting better, if better is the word. They're getting more extrovert.
Well, I found a way to escape television. About 4 or 5 years ago, I bought a videotape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have cable television. Does England have cable?
Only in very small areas. I mean, there are sort of experimental cable areas. No, but, I mean, that again is coming, and satellite is going to... I mean, we're going to be very like America within 10 years.
Cable is a wonderful thing, because what they do with cable... On my side of town, there are two cable systems in Manhattan, and on my side of town, I live on the west side, we have our choice of 3 movie channels.
Mm-hmm.
Showtime, Home Box Office, and Uptown. And they are, well, next month, Uptown is running a Charlie Chaplin film festival. Almost all of, even the short films are running everything. A month or so ago, they had an Alfred Hitchcock film festival, all of his films. I don't subscribe to that, unfortunately, but for reasons which are too complicated to tell you. But I do have one of the movie channels, so I record movies usually overnight, while I'm at the office, and then I label the tapes and I file them and everything. I have about 600 movies now,
yeah.
And most of which I never get a chance to watch. But it doesn't occur to me to go and turn on television and watch anything.
No.
It doesn't. I mean, I will go and reach up and get a box of a tape and put that on my cassette player, and I will watch a movie,
yeah.
Which I can shut off if I want. So I just don't watch commercial television.
No. I think that had been happening. An interesting thing that happened in England to sort of change that pattern, because that was the way people were going. But then Channel 4 appeared, which was, I mean, that's the newest television station, and it's independent. I mean, it's ITV, but it's kind of has its own independence from that. And suddenly people were switching on to watch individual programs again, you know, to be the first to actually see the first showing of something new. And the way that, certainly initially, the way the channel was developed, it was so bizarre that there was no chance that you'd want to watch the next thing. So, I mean, there'd be a black situation comedy at 8 o'clock and a program on, you know, how to make doilies for Ethiopia at 8:30 or whatever. And kind of, you know, there is no chance that there'd be any follow-through audience. And it went against all the conventional thinking of television, which is that you kind of make it blander and blander and blander until nobody's got the energy to switch off. Suddenly, here was a station that was doing the opposite. And it was juxtaposing things so different that people were switching on for individual programs. And it had a very stimulating effect, actually. I mean, I think, unfortunately, now it is going a bit the way of the others, mm-hmm. and it's getting blander, and it's got more American football, and, you know, I mean, this is the channel that has developed American football for English audiences, whereas it's...
American
football? I mean, Super Bowl, big event.
They're carrying the yep. our teams?
Yes, there? Yes, the refrigerator is big news mm-hmm. in Channel 4 viewing. I mean, which is bizarre, but because nobody in England understands American football.
I don't understand it myself. I am not a football fan. I never watch.
People sit and watch mesmerized by the pictures and sort of with disbelief thinking, is this real? Are they really doing this?
There's something else, too, that has undercut American television. The American television audience is getting smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
The network television audience getting smaller. Radio audience too. That's the availability of rental videotapes.
Yeah.
You can, for approximately the equivalent of £1, you can mm-hmm. rent a tape for a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or join a club and get them even less over a long period of time.
Yes.
You have a huge selection. Even at CBS, we have about a program here at CBS in which they, for 50 cents, they will rent us a videotape. And you have a choice of about 1,000 movies.
Yeah.
Take it home. Now, you see people leaving on Fridays. I think they're allowed 3 or 4 tapes, but you see everybody walking out of the elevators carrying their tapes. They're going to watch it over the weekend. And then what this means is that they're not watching network television.
Right. And I think what has also happened, which is just a chronological thing, is that kind of now, the children growing up now, well, I mean, in their teens, 20s, hardly children, but the people growing up now, are the first generation for whom television is kind of, has no excitement at all. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, I'm now 40, a lot of people didn't have televisions, and there was a kind of excitement when people got television. And certainly in England during that period, 50s and 60s, television was developing, colour was coming, etc. Television was expanding, it was a more exciting medium, it was something to watch. Whereas my kids are growing up, and for them, television is something mummy and daddy watch. You
they
know,
probably have Walkmans.
I.e. boring.
They've
got Walkmans, they've got all that. They'll watch what they want to watch on television. But it's not, I mean, it is no longer, there is no longer any excitement in watching television. They recognise, for them, it is a boring sort of, you know, last resort. If they can't think of anything else to do, they'll watch television. And that's because we watch it a lot, probably. I mean, there is no naughtiness in watching television. There is no.
Just think of all of the options you have. You don't have to watch network television. You can, with cable, you can turn on MTV, or you can turn on a movie, or you can put a tape on. We have the new compact disc, thanks to Sony. We have the Walkmans, thanks to Sony. We have these new miniaturized cameras, thanks to Sony. Sony's really taken over, as before. And a computer, computers and modems to reach other computers, that's huge in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have so many different things that you can do with your life that nobody has to sit there and watch television anymore.
No. And I think the product, you know, television hasn't responded by getting more exciting. It's responded by playing safe, and which is wrong because it doesn't work. You know, it said, we're in a bad state, so what do we do? I mean, there are two things you do when you're in a bad state. One is you do something completely different, and the other is you say, well, that was successful, let's do something like that. And unfortunately, television is taking the second option. And I mean, you just get more and more sort of, you know, follow-up series or series using the same stars as, you know, just, I mean, in other words, dilution. Mm-hmm. Just sort of the fifth carbon copy of a success. And that's happening more and more.
Well, Simon Brett, I certainly enjoyed that giveaway and my introduction to Charles Paris. I look forward to reading The Return of Charles Paris when he comes back to solve another crime.
There'll be more. Yes.
And I have one request of you. When you leave the United States to go back to England, would you please take Benny Hill back with you?
Yes, I wish. I'm amazed. I mean, I just cannot think how he ever got across the channel. And not the channel. No, it's bigger than that, isn't it?
I don't know how he got through customs.
No. I mean, you know, I have no answer to that. I am, on behalf of my great nation, ashamed.
You should be very apologetic.
I am.
However, we're giving you horrible game shows and football, so I guess it works out evenly.
It was a kind of trade.
Simon Brett, thank you very much.
Thank you.